you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, a live literary event series from LAist. We are back with guests, author Amanda Montell, and actor Bella Lavelle. You can find us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum. Tickets at laist.com/events.
From the Mome Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. A state audit reveals some schools in the UC system had inappropriate factors influence admissions. We'll hear what they consider inappropriate. Plus, while California has its highest voter registration rate in 80 years, there are still two groups of people that need a little extra outreach to make sure they cast their ballot. Find out who ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for being with us. Coming up,
there is a big issue with disinformation and lack of assistance.
21 million people are registered to vote in California, more than any other year since 1940, but registration among Latinos and Asian Americans continues to be lower than others. We're going to explore why that is and what can be done just ahead. But first, a state audit found the University of California system admitted 64 students through, quote, inappropriate channels during the previous five school years. Now, those channels include students' connections to big donors and being admitted through athletic programs, despite showing little ability in those sports. Now, if this sounds like the admission scandal that rocked college campuses nationwide last year, including at USC, you are not far off. Here to talk about this is Margarita Fernandez, Chief of Public Affairs for the California State Auditor, which authored this report. Now, first off, just how much was this report motivated by that admission scandal?
It was very much so motivated by that. Assemblymember Werner Horvath is the one that requested the audit, and they were concerned about what had happened with the scandal and UC's responses to some of these allegations. So it's all related to that. They wanted to make sure that corrective action was being taken. So they requested the audit, asking us to go to three universities, UC Berkeley, UCLA, and UC San Diego. Then we added UC Santa Barbara when we were looking at, in particular, student athletes.
How did you go about auditing them?
We actually started looking at any admissions that were made, in particular with exception, and then looked at emails. We looked at information about the student athlete program, whether or not they were on rosters. So we took a deeper dive into all of the practices.
Now, your report found 64 cases of applicants who got into one of the more competitive UC schools, even though compared against the academics, against others, they might not have made the cut. And your report calls them, quote, inappropriate factors. Now, I referenced a few earlier, but can you give us a few more details of what you count as inappropriate?
We're really talking about perhaps this, a student or an applicant was well-connected. Maybe the applicant's family member was the child of a high-level university staff member, or maybe they were a child of a major donor, or perhaps it was a child of a prominent alumnus. So that's what we're talking about.
Now, your report notes that most of these students were white and from families with incomes of more than $150,000 a year. Why make that specific point?
Well, that was something that the requester asked us to take a look at as well, the demographics and so forth. It was something they were concerned about, whether or not individuals who perhaps came from a background that didn't have the connections, didn't have all the contacts, or perhaps weren't related to a major donor.
We're talking to Margarita Fernandez, Chief of Public Affairs for the California State Auditor. Now, for perspective, UC schools admitted nearly 150,000 students for this academic year alone, finding 64 cases of possibly inappropriate admissions over the course of five previous school years. I got to be honest, does not sound like a lot.
Yeah, we only looked at four campuses, but there were 400 others that were questionable that we found. And we also, on top of that, looked at the entire admission practices. Some of these reviewers, they have two reviewers per application, and they're not trained, not monitored. So I might be someone who's applying and might get lucky, and I have someone who is lenient.
But isn't that just the luck of the draw, though, Margarita? I mean, it's just, you know, sometimes we're all human beings, and sometimes people are more strict and sometimes people are more lenient.
You're right. It's the luck of a draw. There's always going to be some subjective nature in this because we're all human. But training them, monitoring their work, trying to make sure that they have the equipment or the tools that they need to try to make it as consistent as possible is something that you would, that the university should want to do to make sure that people trust the system.
On the point, though, of training people doing the reviewing, something stood out to me in the summary of recommendations, and I'll just read it verbatim here. Before admitting prospective student athletes, verify their athletic talents. I don't know if I could recognize someone who is an expert rower or diver. How is that going to be done to make sure that the people doing the reviewing of, say, someone that's trying to become a student at a UC campus that is an athlete is legitimately an athlete?
What we saw a lot of is email correspondence between like the development department, which is the fundraising arm for the university, and perhaps coach. When you're looking at the students, not necessarily the reviewer, but it could be someone else who is taking a look at that. Someone external, perhaps from the coach, that even just investigates a little bit to determine if that person plays in high school and how well they've done in high school. You can Google and get some information fairly easily. So even just doing a review or trying to validate that that person, in fact, is a top rated in that particular sport would give some comfort as far as knowing whether or not these individuals who are called a student athlete are in fact a student athlete.
Okay. Now, I understand overseeing and reviewing the admissions process is important, and you made those recommendations to shore up that process. But what's on the line when the state almost micromanages each UC school's methods for who gets admitted?
So, you know, we recognize that, too, that the campuses need to have some autonomy as well. But the Office of the President could take a little bit stronger role. They have a system-wide auditor. So they do have the ability to try to ensure that they can build a public trust in this admissions process, that it's not going to be unfair depending on what your connections are with the university. So just even ensuring that they do a review every 3 years or so still gives campuses the autonomy of ensuring that they're implementing certain admission practices.
Ultimately, though, it does depend on state lawmakers and the schools themselves. So I'm wondering, who should the public look to for making changes with our public universities going forward?
We can't enforce the corrective action, but, you know, the public can. Also to the legislature. Legislature provide funding to the university every year. They will often have hearings on any of the audits that we conduct, and the legislature can enforce some action on this.
That's Margarita Fernandez, Chief of Public Affairs for the California State Auditor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. Today, a federal judge in California will hear arguments over the 2020 census. After the pandemic hit, the Census Bureau planned an 8-month revised process for the population count. Then, last month, federal officials abruptly shortened that time by a month. Now, plaintiffs from the city of L.A. and several nonprofits are asking for a preliminary injunction to stop the Trump administration from implementing that truncated plan. They're hoping to keep the Census Bureau counting residents through the end of October. KPCC's Caroline Champlin has been making sense of the census for us. And before we get into what's happening today, Caroline, can you remind us why this lawsuit is significant for L.A.? Why is it a problem if the census is shorter?
Sure. So it's really not a coincidence that the city of LA is fighting in this lawsuit. It's because we're already really vulnerable to an undercount. So if the 2020 census is rushed, it's just sort of exacerbating the existing risks here. And so just a reminder, most Angelenos live in areas that are considered hard to count. And usually that means like really dense or multi-unit buildings. But the lack of internet access and language barriers are also important factors to consider. So that's sort of our starting point, which is already disadvantaged. And the shorter the census is, the more likely those people will be missed. Or actually more likely, census workers will just end up asking people's neighbors to respond for them, which is something that actually happens, but it's really not ideal. And so it's just not disputable. A former census director said it. Even the Census Bureau has said it. A shorter census will be less accurate.
All right, so what's at stake for Angelenos if the count is inaccurate?
All right, well, so there's three ways to explain this because the stakes can sort of be hard to grasp and it just sort of depends on what your priorities are. But let me start with politics because I imagine if you're listening to Take Two, you're probably a politics fan a little bit. And so the census will change politics in LA. City council districts, supervisors district, state assembly districts, and U.S. representative districts are all drawn based on census data. And that means voters get regrouped and that changes who gets elected and the issues that get attention in LA. And sort of the really shocking things in terms of politics is that this year, California is likely to lose a representative in the U.S. Congress for the first time in history. That's because our population growth has slowed down compared to other states. But if there's an undercount, it's likely we'll lose even more influence in D.C. And experts say that an L.A. district is the most likely to get cut out. So that's politics. But let's also talk about money. Because over $1 trillion is going to get distributed based on the 2020 census, which is obviously just a ton of money. And in California, most of our federal money goes to healthcare like Medi-Cal and Medicaid, but a lot goes to public schools and programs like school lunches. But if those things don't get your attention, the big LA stakes, the census determines the quality and efficiency of our freeways.
Yikes.
If we're not represented, our freeways will, be even worse than they already are. And so it helps determine, it also helps determine resources for disaster preparedness. And so if the census just doesn't fully recognize the residents of LA and sort of like the sheer size of LA, our region will get less attention for the next decade, which is a long time.
To know that freeways could actually get worse, Caroline, I mean, you would think everyone would jump up and say, yes, count me, I am here. All right, so where are we in terms of response rates in LA so far?
So this is sort of divided into two things. There's the self-response rate, which is people who did the census on their own over the phone or the internet or by the mail. And those response rates are pretty low. They're at 63% in the county, which isn't great. The state is at 68%, so they're ahead of us. And then there's also the completion rate. That's the rate of, how many enumerators have like actually gone out and helped people fill out the census. And the Census Bureau says that rate is actually pretty high, that the enumerators have done a lot of good work and they've reached a lot of people and most people are getting counted. But sort of one thing to consider is, like I mentioned before, census workers can sometimes ask people's neighbors for information about you. And that's really not the best way to get counted because somebody else is sort of giving your information and they might not get it right. And so even though the Census Bureau is saying, we're doing really good work and we're getting a lot of people counted, they might not be getting counted in the most accurate way.
All right. So let's get into the hearing that's actually happening right now. What's the argument from the plaintiffs? Why do they say the census schedule should be extended again?
The main argument from the plaintiffs is that the Trump administration didn't have a reasonable explanation for shortening the census. They argue that it was arbitrary and capricious. And so the plaintiffs and the judge have spent the last few weeks of this lawsuit trying to unearth documentation from the Census Bureau because they said, OK, if this wasn't arbitrary, can you show us your work? What experts did you consult? Who drafted this shortened plan? And in the last few days, finally, some documents have come out and they've showed that within the Census Bureau, officials agreed that a shortened census would have produced and could produce flawed results. And then there's also this other critical finding that came out from the Inspector General in the Department of Commerce, which oversees the Census Bureau. They found that the decision to shorten the census didn't come from within the Census Bureau, which is pretty damning. And it makes you wonder who did decide to change the timeline. And some census workers have already sort of speculated, did this come from the Secretary of Commerce? Maybe it came from the president. We don't know. But I think that point will get a lot of attention in court today.
All right. So what arguments are you expecting the Department of Justice lawyers to make in defense of the Trump administration?
Sure. So I think that they're going to be sticking to one argument that they've made all along. And they're saying that the Census Bureau's decision to change the schedule shouldn't be considered final agency action. Basically, they're saying just because the Census Bureau was asked to create this shortened plan, that doesn't mean it was one definitive decision that caused legal consequences. And so they're officially asking for two things. They want the district judge to dissolve the temporary restraining order that has stopped the Census Bureau from wrapping up their work. And so they also don't want a preliminary injunction because that would sort of be a more permanent temporary restraining order that would keep people counting into October.
So what do you think the judge will decide?
So I think it's very likely the judge will order that preliminary injunction to keep Census Bureau officials working into October. And she's actually sort of said that in these court hearings that they've had over the last couple of weeks, is that's what she's interested in doing. And that would be good for LA because it would mean that, you know, people are going door to door for longer and sort of taking longer to actually get responses from individuals. And so that's what's likely to come from her. But then the DOJ lawyers, I should say, throughout this whole process, they've actually said that they want the judge to turn the temporary restraining order into a preliminary injunction, which sort of sounds counterintuitive because they're actually saying in this lawsuit today that they don't want a preliminary injunction. But legal experts have said that maybe they do sort of want a preliminary injunction because they want to just get a ruling and get out of this court so they can appeal it and possibly sort of send this issue to the Supreme Court, which would be a whole different thing. But we'll just have to see what the judge decides first.
That's KPCC's Caroline Champlin making sense of the census for all of us. Caroline, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
California has its highest voter registration rate since 1940. Over 20 million people can cast a ballot. However, that doesn't mean that every single one of those potential voters will. There are two slices of the state's electorate that historically need a little extra outreach. Find out who they are and why they matter so much. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. When it comes to voting in California this year, it looks like we could have a high turnout. Now, the question is, will that turnout be representative of our state's population? You see, more than 21 million people are now registered to vote in California, which is 83% of all eligible voters. But when you break it down by ethnicity, you see quite a different picture. Only 70% of eligible Latinos and 54% of eligible Asian voters are registered right now in the state. And these groups have historically had lower voter turnout than others. So why is that and what can be done? Joining us to discuss are three experts on the subject. Mindy Romero is the founder and director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy at USC's Sol Price School of Public Policy. Dulce Rojas is a campaign coordinator for Voto Latino. And Daniel Jun is a voting rights attorney at Asian Americans Advancing Justice LA. Mindy Romero starts us off.
The good news here is that registration numbers are higher for everybody. Registration rates, the percent, is higher for both Latinos and Asian Americans and the general population. But the gap between groups remains, and there is a significant gap, as you can see, between both of these groups and the general population. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done going into the November election if we want to see everybody registered and able to vote.
Well, so that ability to vote, Mindy, that is one thing to be registered, right? And another thing to actually cast that ballot. So how do you expect registrations to correlate with actual voter turnout this year for Latinos and Asian Americans?
It's a great question. So lots of research does show that once a group is registered, turnout rates are much more similar. The gaps are much less. So the battle is, there really is a significant step there in registration. That's a barrier. But still, we know that there will be many Latinos and Asian Americans that don't participate. There's always lower turnout rates for Latinos and Asian Americans on election day. And a key difference is the outreach and the voter education that they get. They're much less likely to get it from typical places like campaigns and candidates. And it's the work of nonprofit groups, community groups, advocacy groups, connecting with them. That's really critical to get them out to participate actually at the ballot box.
Now, Dulce, your organization, Voto Latino, is focused on registering Latino voters across the country. Could you tell us about the work Voto Latino is doing to help get out the vote nationally?
So a lot of the work that we're doing right now is how we can use our digital tools to really reach across the country, especially now during COVID, and really just one, activate non-voters and activate the community in general. And then also getting people out to the polls, not just register to vote, but actually getting, you know, civically engaged. So a lot of the work that we're doing right now is really just trying to get people to get motivated to plug in with us. Text Bank, just in these last 5 months, we've texted over 800,000 people and signed up for volunteers. 4,000 volunteers are getting active with us. So a lot of the work that we're doing is really just trying to get people to text people. That's the simplest way to explain it. And we're really seeing the fruits of our labor with an increase in voter registration and increase in engagement on all of our platforms.
Is that increase in voter registration, how is that increase in Latinos in California compared to other parts of the country?
Let's see. So we've registered this cycle alone almost 300,000 people, but California, we've gotten 7,000 new applications in just this cycle. This is great, but we can definitely do better, which is why we're still arming up our super volunteers and our volunteer army to text out and really to do more to reach out compared to other states that really saw a bigger boost in the use of our digital tools. So we're hoping to make sure that, you know, we ramp up efforts, we really get the word out to our community, because there's a lot of issues that, you know, from language access to not trusting the government. And, you know, with everything going on from A to Z, we are trying to make sure that the message gets across clear that, you know, we are here to help you get registered. We are here to inform you, and we are here to respond to people's needs.
You mentioned language access and not trusting the government. If you had to choose, Dulce, one of those two as the top maybe obstacle to making Latinos get out there and vote, what would be the top one?
For the community that we are targeting, which is young Latinx 18-35, the biggest challenge has been the disinformation that, you know, our community is getting targeted. Disinformation and distrust going hand in hand, not really trusting that their vote is going to get counted with a vote by mail, not understanding how that works, and not trusting that their ballot is going to get into the hands of the appropriate agency or people. So that, I would say, is the number one issue we're dealing with right now.
So Daniel, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, LA, is working on finding voters who may encounter difficulties casting their ballots. So could you tell us about the challenges among Asian American voters that you're working to address?
Yeah, of course. Advancing Justice, you know, we've long championed for people to be able to meaningfully vote and, you know, understand what they're doing. That means being able to vote comfortably in the language that you're most comfortable with. That's been a little bit more difficult with all the COVID regulations and things like that, where a lot of the support that you get for, you know, the language that you're most comfortable with might come in person, where you go to the voting booth and there might be someone like a bilingual poll worker there who could help you throughout, you know, the whole process, or there might be a translated ballot that sort of tells you exactly how you want to be able to vote. So with the mail-in ballot process, we're a little bit worried that, you know, people might not be able to meaningfully get that support that they have historically had, and people who need a translated ballot might not be able to get one, or might not sort of go through the hoops to get the proper ballot that they need. So we've been doing a lot of work trying to reach out to those communities who might need it, or make sure that they know what's going on. And so we're making sure that everyone knows that, you know, you can vote in numerous different languages throughout California and throughout the country. We're trying to make sure that, you know, the counties have enough in-person voting opportunities available to the people who want or, you know, need those in-person services, and making sure that people know that they can still vote in person, and that all those in-person opportunities have, that they're confident that the in-person opportunities are both safe for them and safe for their vote process. Throughout the election, we're also going to have a hotline available in multiple different languages so people can call in with whatever questions they have every step of the way so that they can be confident that the ballot that they cast gets in the right hands.
Daniel, let me ask you this, because so when it comes for Latinos and language issue on the ballots, generally Spanish will cast the widest net on Latinos. I know there's certain indigenous languages in certain Spanish-speaking countries, but generally Spanish would be the widest net. When it comes to Asian Americans, in an ideal world, Daniel, how many languages would be available to cover every Asian American in the United States that could vote?
LA at least is translating their ballots into 18 different languages. And so, you know, and that's not even covering all the ones that are needed, right?
Daniel, so on that, would it be realistic to ask to ask that ballots be in as many different Asian languages as possible? Or is it one of those things where there's just too many and it's just not possible?
I definitely think that, you know, if we're going to have a meaningful right to vote, to the extent that people can do that in as many languages as possible, I think that's definitely important for people to, you know, exercise and participate in a democracy.
We're talking to Mindy Romero, founder and director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy at USC Sol Price School of Public Policy. Also, Luce Rojas, campaign coordinator for Voto Latino, and Daniel Jun, a voting rights attorney at Asian Americans Advancing Justice LA. Now, this one's for all three of you, because I want to hear from each of you in terms of what is the most common question you get from Latino and Asian American residents about voting. Mindy, let's start with you on that.
Well, I mean, it changes, right? I think right now in the context that we're all in, there are a lot of questions about whether their ballot will count, period, whether there's fraud. Then there's also just the nuts and bolts questions, you know, how do you actually use vote by mail? How do you get it in? Period, across the board, voters often don't know that their ballot is going to be verified when it's processed and that they have to sign it and make sure their signature is accurate, you know, compared to their signature on file at the registration's office or registrar's office. So a lot of just questions about, particularly now, how do I make sure my ballot actually is going to get counted? And it's really unfortunate. And the impact from that can potentially even, you know, make voters wonder if they should be voting at all.
Luce, what about you? What's the most common question you get?
Yeah, I think Mindy hit the nail on the head. And, you know, the biggest issue and question that we're trying to answer in all of our text banking efforts and engaging voters on a one-on-one basis is how can I make sure that my vote gets counted? And we still get pushback saying, I just prefer to make my vote in person because it's too important to me. And then we get on the other side of the aisle, you know, with folks that are just so done with, you know, all the disinformation that they're getting targeted and thrown their way. They're feeling confused. They're not understanding the process of vote by mail. Many of our communities, we also need to understand, are in mixed family households. So not all voters will have the opportunity for someone to help them. You know, this is how you can sign off to make sure that your name is matching, like Mindy was saying, right? Or this is how to properly fill out the ballot. So this is the biggest concern that we're seeing, that, you know, how can I get this information to my aunt, to my uncle in a different city, state? So we're doing the best we can to address all these little details and questions that people have, but there is a big issue with disinformation and lack of assistance. And I think that also needs to also fall not just on the shoulders of organizations, but also election officials to ramp up efforts to expand assistance and outreach and provide information on how to cast their votes properly.
Daniel, what about you? Most common question you get from Asian American residents about voting?
Yeah, I think Dulce and Mindy really hit the main points. We've drastically sort of changed the processes to vote. So I don't know if there's a single one question, but there's a lot of sort of misconceptions about, you know, ways that people can vote and the sort of, you know, safety nets that are behind all of those different methods of voting. And so, you know, we have a lot of concerns of like, can we safely vote in person? Will we be able to vote in person? Or how do the drop boxes work or things like that?
Mindy, how do you think of vote by mail? Because California mandated to ensure that every registered voter gets a ballot by mail. How do you think vote by mail will affect turnout among Latinos and Asian Americans?
So, you know, overall, vote by mail looks like it's a positive impact on turnout, but it's not necessarily across the board. Outreach, particularly from trusted messengers like my colleagues here on the line, it's really, really critical to making sure that this November, when we see a much larger, we assume to some degree, use of vote by mail and across the state, that people get the message, they learn about it, they feel comfortable in it, and they can execute it if that is their choice to use vote by mail.
So Mindy, looking forward a little bit then, what impact could these two demographics have on the November election?
Well, a lot. Period, but particularly in a state like California. So in the 2016 general election, for instance, Latinos were about 22% of all voters, still underrepresented compared to their numbers in the population and amongst eligible voters, but 22% is pretty significant. Asian Americans were another almost 8% of voters. So in any given election, Latinos and Asian Americans in California help decide races, period. But again, there's still lots of room to grow, lots of work that has to be done in terms of making sure that they are fully represented in the election, having higher registration rates, having turnout rates equal to other groups, other race, racial and ethnic groups is just so important. Every year as these populations grow, they have an ever increasing influence and say in California politics, but it's still underrepresented.
That's Mindy Romero, the founder and director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy at USC Sol Price School of Public Policy. Also with us, Dulce Rojas, campaign coordinator for Voto Latino, and Daniel Jun, a voting rights attorney at Asian Americans Advancing Justice LA. Mindy, Dulce, and Daniel, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you've been thinking about taking a staycation, the LA hotel industry would not only love you for it, but they're desperate for you to do it. Especially all those high-end, fancy, swanky hotels, because they're barely surviving. Some of them are on the brink right now. And that means a lot of room and concierge attendants are going to be out of a job. Coming up, find out how close to the edge LA's hotel biz stands. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. The closure of the Lux Rodeo Drive Hotel, reported earlier this week by the Los Angeles Times, is the first big sign of the challenges the industry has faced because of the pandemic. The Beverly Hills Hotel told its employees that it had to shut its doors because financial constraints are caused by COVID-19. Now, the question is, who's next? As many hotels in the LA area remain closed or only open in a limited capacity. For more on this, we're joined now by Heather Roseman, Executive Director of the Hotel Association of Los Angeles. Can you give us a sense of how hard hit the industry has been by the pandemic and how many other hotels here are at risk of closing?
Yes, absolutely. The hospitality industry and hotels in particular have really been devastated. Since the beginning of the pandemic and stay-at-home orders, at least 157 LA County hotels have suspended operations during the pandemic. As of last week, 38 hotels are still closed, which is really a significant loss, not only for the industry and its workers, but also for the local municipalities. Last year, LA hotels collected $332 million in transient occupancy tax. This tax is a fund that goes towards essential city services like street paving, potholes, tree trimming, to fire safety and paramedics. So this has a really big ripple effect on the communities that our hotels do work in.
Heather, of the 38 that are closed, is that permanently closed?
That remains to be seen. We're not sure whether or not this is a temporary suspension. We hope that many of these hotels will reopen early 2021, but that still remains to be seen.
Now, the hotels that are most at risk, are we talking about high-end luxury hotels or hotels in certain areas?
Absolutely not. I hear stories from the small mom and pops that have had these hotel businesses in their families for four generations, all the way up to the big towers that rely on convention business. And as we all know, conventions are still not allowed to be taking place. So we're not sure when business will return to normal for large and small hotels alike.
So all hotels are vulnerable, Heather. But what makes luxury hotels particularly vulnerable in circumstances like this?
Well, like I mentioned, the convention business and the business traveler market has grinded to a halt. Hotels still have hard costs like mortgages, taxes, insurance, water, power, maintenance, and security. All of these required costs don't go away just because the business isn't there. I would also add that on top of all of these hard costs, hotels are still paying for employee health insurance, paid sick leave, and hotels have also made substantial investments in these enhanced COVID clean and safety procedures and programs, purchasing PPE, masks, gloves, hand sanitizer. It's a very expensive time to do business as well.
Is the overhead on those luxury hotels, is that just too big to try and sustain with the way we are right now?
Right now, hotels are seeing occupancy in about the 40% range. When the pandemic first started, we were in the single digits. So while we're seeing some return of leisure travel to the hotel market in the greater Los Angeles area, many hotels are still operating at a very substantial room rate discount as well. So that really compounds the impact.
Now, we've read about a high loan delinquency rate among hotel borrowers. Can you explain that for us and why are so many hotels behind on their loans?
When you take all the factors I just mentioned into account, this really paints a devastating picture for the industry. These fixed costs, the cost of doing business, and then the lack of business is really what is contributing to the inability for hotels to make ends meet.
Now, for the higher-end hotels, can they stay afloat by offering limited services or discounting, as you mentioned? I mean, is that something that can keep them afloat for a little while to try and ride this out?
I think one component of keeping business operational throughout the pandemic is scaling back some of those services. So many of the hotels have shuttered their restaurants, are not doing room service, and folks are having to order in from another restaurant to have a dine-in experience. But I think the ability for hotels to get back on their feet is really going to depend on how well we all do as a community to flatten the curve.
Talking to Heather Roseman, Executive Director of the Hotel Association of Los Angeles. Worst case scenario, if a lot of these hotels were to close, what would happen to the properties themselves? Is there any chance at all that they could serve maybe alternative functions, like maybe condos, student housing?
Yes, some hotels are definitely considering selling the property. I know that the City of Los Angeles is looking to procure hotel rooms for Project Room Key. And so there's quite a few hotels that may be working with the local governments to repurpose those properties for other uses.
Now, on that point, there's been a lot of talk about using hotels or motels as solutions to homelessness. Could this hotel industry crisis tip the scales at all on that?
Yes, Project Room Key was actually a pretty big success. If you would have asked me in 2019 if we would be able to next year take 4,000 Angelenos off the street and find them shelter, I would have told you that that was a huge success. And so as it currently sits, Project Room Key has been a slow-moving program as it's never been done before. We started working with the city in April to find appropriate locations for this Project Room Key endeavor. The criteria was really looking for exterior corridors, limited points of entry, and a full hotel contract.
One more thing, Heather. Could the government or maybe the banks step in to help these struggling hotels?
Yes, absolutely. We've seen a lot of support from the federal government. When you take into account all of the contributors that the hotel market has to the success of local municipalities, it's an important business for the local governments to consider assisting.
That's Heather Roseman. She's Executive Director of the Hotel Association of Los Angeles. Heather, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
pandemic has also claimed another business casualty, our all-you-can-eat fried shrimp.
There's a lot of reasons why we came to Sizzler for all-you-can-eat shrimp. The shrimp are really good.
All-you-can-eat.
And you get a thick sirloin steak.
With shrimp. All-you-can-eat.
Yeah, the restaurant chain Sizzler declared bankruptcy yesterday. It got its humble start right here in Southern California in 1958 as Dell's Sizzler Family Steakhouse in Culver City. Now, back then, you could get a steak for 99 cents. Over time, it grew with locations all over the country, mostly here in California. Then in the 1980s, when red meat was falling out of fashion, the business built up its famous buffet and salad bar to be stacked with more greenery and healthy foods. You might have your own memories of going there with your family. I used to trade my baked potato for my brother's cheese toast. It was a fair trade. He didn't complain. Now, like many similarly styled restaurants, Sizzler had already been struggling. Then came COVID-19. And the concept of sharing the same tongs as other people to scoop up iceberg lettuce and lasagna from behind sneeze guards, a little too hard to swallow there. Now, it's not completely over for Sizzler, though, in its 107 locations. The kind of bankruptcy it's filing, Chapter 11, means it's trying to reorganize its debts. Plus, locations are still open for takeout. If you have more than a dollar ready for that steak, though, you're going to need it because nowadays that New York strip costs about a cool, crisp $20 bill. All right, so maybe no more Sizzler steak and cheese toast, but what about a Monte Cristo sandwich, Plaza Inn fried chicken, corn dogs, churros, Mickey beignets? How about that? Disneyland. Disneyland might be opening. We'll get all the details when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. You can get this show as a podcast wherever you like to listen. I'm E. Martinez. Orange County is now at the moderate or orange level on the state color-coded COVID-19 watch list. Now, that means some non-essential businesses are open with modifications. But one business that employs thousands of people and brings big revenue dollars to the area remains closed. That's Disneyland. Today, the Walt Disney Company put pressure on Governor Gavin Newsom to allow theme parks to reopen. And joining us now is Mike Rowe. He's the arts and entertainment reporter for our website, LAist. All right, Mike. So today, Josh D'Amaro, chairman of Disney Parks Experiences and Products, held a conference call, which you got to listen to. What was his message for California's lawmakers?
He outlined the evidence that it's worth it to reopen the Disneyland and California Adventure parks and specifically called on Governor Newsom to tell them what they need to do to reopen. They've been shut down since March, and this follows calls from Orange County recently, with Orange County mayors calling for the state to let them reopen.
What does Disney mean, Mike, when they say we need guidelines that are fair and equitable?
You know, the state announced months ago that they had prepared guidelines to reopen theme parks across the state, but they held off on releasing those when Black Lives Matter protests started to happen, as well as increased COVID-19 spread across the state. As different businesses have started to reopen, though, there have been guidelines released for almost every kind of business, but not for theme parks. Mm-hmm. And right now, no matter what COVID-19 tier your county is in, there's no option to reopen theme parks. No guidelines have been provided yet.
All right, so what was D'Amaro's argument for reopening the Anaheim parks?
You know, D'Amaro and other Disney executives pointed to parks that have reopened around the world, from Disney World to China. You know, they talked about the protocols they put in place in Florida and also what they're learning with each reopening that is helping them to inform what they're doing with their other parks. You know, they noted in particular that since reopening, COVID-19 spread actually went down in Central Florida after Disney World reopened. And some of those safety measures they started to use include things you might expect, like they have temperature checks, face masks, increased sanitation. They're also using plexiglass shields in areas where you can't or it's difficult to socially distance, mm-hmm. as well as a virtual line system, mobile dining, and just any other way they can use to keep people apart from each other. In Florida, they even have park employees helping to enforce social distancing and telling people to move away from each other.
Move away. Now, and Mike, I see that Disney has designed custom masks for its employees. What do we know about those?
You know, they've been redesigning these. They're currently in their third generation of sort of iterating and figuring out how to make masks that they park employees can wear all day long when it's in hot areas and helping protect both them and visitors from the spread of COVID-19. They know that the masks are designed both for safety and for comfort, and they're also taking feedback from the staff to try to keep making those better.
If they all got in Disney character costumes, right? That could work,
exactly.
Right? They'd be protected. They'd be protecting everyone else too. Now, okay, so why hasn't Disneyland or California Adventure reopened? I mean, if movie theaters can reopen in Orange County with severe restrictions on how many tickets they can sell, I mean, to ensure the social distancing, I gotta imagine, Mike, they could do something like that for Disneyland. I mean, doesn't that sound logical?
I mean, it's a good question, especially given what a good portion of those theme parks offer is outside. But there's been some concerns that have seemed to keep the state from moving forward on theme parks due to issues like the large number of people gathering at the parks. That's one reason they've actually shut down the parades and things like fireworks shows that would make people more likely to gather when they've reopened at Disney World. So whenever Disneyland reopens, I wouldn't expect to go to those kind of events. But there's also concern about potential spread on surfaces and the rides and how often they're able to sort of disinfect those surfaces, as well as just the chance to spread through the air, especially when you're on like a fast moving ride and you're right behind the air coming out from other people. So it can be a difficult place to figure out. And I think they're still trying to figure out what would happen.
You just to put a shiver up my spine thinking about that. Yikes. All right. Now, Diamaro says that 80,000 Orange County jobs are affected by the closure of the theme parks. Now, that's a lot of people feeling a really tough economic impact. What do we know about how the company is taking care of its employees during this time?
You know, there's still thousands of Disney employees at Disneyland that are out on furlough, but the company noted that they are trying to provide access to resources online for these people who are already furloughed, as well as they announced there's a plan that's being finalized that will allow Disney staff to get COVID-19 testing in their own local communities and help make sure that everyone there is safe.
Mike, you and I have talked before about how much I love going to watch movies in a theater. I love the experience, love everything about it, but I ain't going back for a long, long time. I've already worked that out in my brain. So I want to ask you, Mike, how quickly would you go back if Disneyland were to open anytime soon, say tomorrow?
You know, I have planned to go there and report on it when it happens and see what it's like. But I also think I will be avoiding riding any of the rides.
The way you describe that one. Imagine if you're in someone's, I don't want to think about it. Mike Rowe is arts and entertainment reporter for LAist. And you can find his latest post on this story there right now. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
In closing, to end on a bit of a positive note here, California Governor Gavin Newsom said the state is taking small steps forward to contain two threats that continue to harm Californians, wildfire and coronavirus. Cap Radio's Ezra David Romero explains.
There are 27 major wildfires still burning in California. They've burned millions of acres, around 22 times more than the acreage consumed at this time last year. Newsom says the large fires are slowly being contained.
Now five of the top 10 most impacted wildfires in our state's history are continuing to burn, though with real progress on some of those larger complexes.
Newsom says smoke from fires and the heat wave prevented people from getting tested for coronavirus. But now he says testing is slowly on the rise again and positivity rates are going down. Still, Newsom says there's a potential threat later this year. The flu and COVID-19 could create a twindemic. He says if the flu isn't also taken seriously by the public, hospitals could become overwhelmed. To help avoid that, he says, get a flu shot. In Sacramento, I'm Ezra David Romero.
It'd be nice to avoid a twindemic. Please, 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 let's avoid a twindemic. All right, you can find the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you missed today's show, yesterday's show, last week, we're all there waiting to be heard by you. Just head to wherever you find them. You can also find us on social media. We're on Twitter, @Take2. That's @Take2. I'm there as well, @AMartinezLA. That's @AMartinezLA. And that's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.